Radio.
Same-sex marriage won't affect you? Some consequences and considerations. A talk by Monica Duman at the Macquarie University Catholic Society's Life Week.
Alrighty, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here and for coming out in the middle of the courtyard in quite a warm day. It's quite nice that we have some shade here. I didn't know that we were going to have it, and I thought that I would be kind of one step away from one of those street preachers with the milk crate. But this will do just nicely. Okay, so the topic of my address today is same-sex marriage won't affect you. Some consequences and considerations. What this means is I'm not going to explore all of the pros and cons of the redefinition of marriage or really discuss the Catholic position on sexual ethics more broadly, but rather confine myself to considering whether changing the law to legalise same-sex marriage might have ramifications for the community. A couple of months ago, Senators Penny Wong and Corey Bernardi debated the redefinition of marriage at the National Press Club. In her opening statement, Senator Wong said this: "If we achieve marriage equality, most things won't change. The sun will rise, heterosexual marriages won't crumble, three-year-olds will still want more ice cream than is good for them, but together we would have made a profound change." The argument is simple. The legalisation of same-sex marriage will have no impact on those not in same-sex relationships, nor will it impact those who might hold the position that marriage is and only ever can be between a man and a woman. But as attractive as the simplicity of that argument might be, I don't think it holds when you look at the experience in Australia when it comes to other marriage trends, nor does it hold when we look at the experience in other countries where same-sex marriage has been legalised. And that's what I'd like to speak about today. In Australian law at the moment, marriage is defined as the union of a man and a woman, to the exclusion of all others, voluntarily entered into for life. This means that marriage has four components. It's heterosexual because it is the union of a man and a woman. It is monogamous because it is to the exclusion of all others. It is voluntary and it is permanent. Each of these four pillars of marriage is key to our understanding of what marriage is, and also key to understanding why governments are involved with marriage at all. And the reason that governments get involved with marriage is because of its link to children. It's in the interests of governments that mothers and fathers are bound to each other and to the children that they create. And that's really why we have laws about marriage. That's why the legal definition of marriage contains the pillars of monogamy and permanence. It is so that families are bound together and that children, and that there are identifiable persons in the community with responsibility for children. Marriage laws are not about providing public recognition or honour to a romantic, committed relationship. If human beings were able to reproduce asexually, there'd be no laws on marriage at all. We have marriage laws because of the link between marriage and children. And this is important because if we change the marriage laws in a way that does away with the very reason for their existence in the first place, then we can expect resultant changes in our social fabric. Laws shape culture, and so changing the law will also change the culture. This is because once we have a law which says that something is legally permitted, a cultural shift occurs where it becomes accepted and then completely normal. Let's take a look at one of the other pillars of marriage, the idea of marriage being for life, and how the community was affected with the introduction of no-fault divorce. We're just about to mark the 40th anniversary of no-fault divorce becoming legal in this country. Prior to the Family Law Act of 1975, there needed to be a reason for divorce to occur. Adultery, alcohol or drug abuse, imprisonment, insanity or cruelty were included amongst the 14 grounds for which divorce was possible. The introduction of no-fault divorce had really good intentions. It could reduce the hostility of divorce proceedings, removed the need for character assassinations within breakups, and made it easier for the couple to maintain a civil relationship, which was a fantastic thing, particularly when children were involved. It also meant that proof was not necessary when one party was seeking to leave an abusive relationship. In all of this, there was never an intention to destroy or even affect marriage. The same comments that Senator Wong made in her debate opening about same-sex marriage could easily have been made in relation to no-fault divorce. If we achieve no-fault divorce, the sun will still rise, heterosexual marriages won't crumble, and so on and so forth. But with the benefit of hindsight, we can see now that a change in law did change the culture. Maybe not immediately, but over a generation or two, it absolutely did. Today, more than a third of all marriages end in divorce. Because once no-fault divorce became legal, it became acceptable and then almost normative. Divorce used to be a big deal. We would be shocked by it, or at least saddened. Now, people throw divorce parties. Some don't even take the as long as we both shall live vows, but something else like as long as we both shall love. No-fault divorce began a cultural shift which saw the emotional connection between the adults and not the provision of a stable home for children as being the primary consideration when it came to marriage. Generations of children have grown up in families experiencing separation and divorce, meaning they grew up learning that it is not fundamental to marriage that it lasts forever. This means it's now more difficult to expect longevity in marriage, and this is in effect in just 40 years, which has been broader than for those just involved in divorce proceedings. So my initial point is this. People can disagree about whether a change in marriage law to allow same-sex couples to marry will have a positive or negative effect on our understanding of marriage or on our culture. But the experience of no-fault divorce shows us that changing marriage law to remove or amend a key element of marriage does have ramifications for others. Now on to same-sex marriage itself. My proposal today is that there are a number of ways in which the change in marriage laws could affect the entire community, particularly in generations to come. The first effect, I think, is that it would likely undermine the idea that marriage is linked to children. Yes, same-sex couples can and do adopt or use the various reproductive technologies to have children, but the marriage itself and that relationship is not necessarily about children. Children become an optional extra, not something which goes to the core of what it actually means to be married. We've already seen this happening with the widespread use of contraception. Sex can occur without babies, and so marriage can be unrelated to children. But the cultural shift that occurs when that happens is that the focus of marriage switches from the children to the adults. Their feelings and their needs would be the most important consideration when it came to what it meant to be married. And this isn't an accusation of or presumption of selfishness on the part of any couple or couples generally. It's just that if we change the law to allow couples whose sexual activity cannot produce children, we slowly shift our society to a point which says that marriage exists primarily to serve the emotional and physical needs of the adults and not to create a stable environment for children. On the flip side of this, there's also the likelihood that the redefinition of marriage will increase the use of assisted reproductive technologies. Same-sex couples cannot have children of their own without assistance, and so donor gametes and surrogacy come into play. As I said before, same-sex couples already do have children with these technologies, but there's something about marriage which places an expectation that children will be raised within the marriage. Anyone who comes from a family like mine knows that after you get married, the questioning starts. When are you going to have a baby? When are you going to have a baby? And then you have one. When are you going to have another one? When are you going to have another one? There's an expectation for married couples to conceive. Even the human right to marry does not exist on its own. The human right to marry is the right to marry and found a family. And we see it played out in social trends. Even though more than 80% of couples live together before marriage, the overwhelming majority of children are still born within marriage. There's an interesting contradiction at play here. We separate marriage from children while at the same time we still see marriage as the most appropriate environment for children to be raised. So how does this affect the use of reproductive technologies? We'll see an increase of IVF procedures for lesbian couples, but also, and quite troubling, an increase in the surrogacy industry and the resultant pressure to enact legislative change to allow commercial surrogacy here. Paid surrogacy is illegal in Australia, so in order for a male couple to have a child by means other than adoption, they would need to either find a volunteer or altruistic surrogate or pay a surrogate from overseas. Commercial surrogacy in other countries has led to a whole raft of problems. At the moment, the commercial surrogacy hotspots are Cambodia and Nepal, which places poor women at risk of exploitation. women have been trafficked for the purposes of surrogacy or have been required to live in agency accommodation and be monitored for the duration of their pregnancy. I'm not suggesting for a second that the commissioning parents are knowingly exploitative, but there are many surrogacy agencies which have no problem in taking advantage of women. Given the problems with overseas commercial surrogacy, a redefinition of marriage would place great pressure to make surrogacy legal here, but that would have ramifications in itself. Firstly, surrogacy encourages a dualistic view of the woman, that she is somehow separate from the womb. Surrogacy says that a woman can rent out her womb and be unaffected by the carrying of a child for 9 months, and we know that that's not true. Surrogacy also introduces a buyer-seller mentality into having children. Consider all of the other goods and services we pay for. We seek to place requirements on how pretty much every service we pay for is performed. How does this manifest in a surrogacy relationship? Diet, exercise, other lifestyle choices, or think about the purchase of goods. If a product that we purchase is not to our satisfaction, we usually want some recourse to the manufacturer. We want some type of compensation. What does this look like in the surrogacy industry? Is the surrogate mother even permitted to make healthcare decisions throughout her pregnancy, or would the commissioning parents have a say? The doctor is usually required to have their patient as a primary concern, but would they be placed in a conflicting position if their client, the one paying the bills, were the intending parents? Just like overseas, commercial surrogacy could result in the exploitation of women in this country. And the redefinition of marriage would increase pressure for commercial surrogacy to be available so that married couples could exercise the human right of marriage and founding a family. Indeed, providers in Australia are already lobbying for this change in anticipation of a change in the marriage laws. Moving on from surrogacy for a moment, we've also been hearing stories of children conceived with donor eggs or sperm who are on a desperate search to find their biological parents because they feel that a part of their identity is missing. The redefinition of marriage will affect generations of children as yet unborn. And this is another example of how the redefinition of marriage would change the focus from the children to the adults, even though all human rights instruments tell us that the best interests of the child should be paramount in any decisions made about them. Staying with the theme of children for a moment, another way the legalisation of same-sex marriage would affect others is through the promotion of the idea that there really is no difference between the genders and that mothers and fathers are interchangeable. But the best evidence we have shows that this is untrue. One of the longest running studies in the world on happiness, followed a group of men over a period of 70 years to find out the key determinants of happiness in a person's life. The study found that men who had good relationships with their mothers earned more money, were more effective at work and in their professional lives than those whose mothers were distant or absent. The relationship with their father, good or bad, did not affect their professional success. On the other hand, good relationships with fathers saw lower rates of adult anxiety, enjoyment of vacations and increased life satisfaction overall. The relationship with mother, good or bad, didn't impact these elements of life satisfaction or happiness. What this tells us is that mothers and fathers are not interchangeable. Both provide different gifts to their children and contribute different elements of a person's flourishing long into their lives. It tells us that creating an institution within which children will be intentionally deprived of a close relationship with mum or dad will have long-term effects on the children of those relationships. Even those who are strong advocates of same-sex marriage understand that the statistics show that there are particular consequences when a parent of a particular gender is removed. US President Barack Obama had this to say about fatherhood. He said, "We know the statistics that children who grow up without a father are 5 times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of schools, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison. They are more likely to have behavioural problems or run away from home or become teenage parents themselves. And the foundations of our community are weaker because of it. Mothers and fathers matter, and the idea that they are interchangeable and that marriages can exist between people of the same gender would undermine this, again to the detriment of children." And it's worth repeating that human rights instruments always tell us that the best interests of the child are paramount. I just want to touch on this one briefly, but another possible effect of the redefinition of marriage in a way that prioritises romantic love between the couple and enshrines a right to have that love publicly acknowledged and celebrated is the potential to expand marriage to other relationships. If love and the intention to commit are the most important aspects of calling a relationship marriage, there's no reason, for example, why a marriage should be limited to two people. I'm not trying to be an alarmist, but it's just the logical conclusion of elevating equal love as being of primary importance. And my final point today is the threat to religious freedom and freedom of conscience, which is where the overseas cases come in. And this isn't the idea so much that priests or other ministers of religion will be forced to perform same-sex weddings, but about others who hold an objection to same-sex marriage. You might, or probably all of you, would have seen recently a case in the United States where county law clerk Kim Davis refused to have licenses for same-sex weddings issued by her office because each license bore her name and her signature, and she considered her signature to be an endorsement of something which went against her conscience. Miss Davis was jailed for a number of days and released on the condition that her office would resume issuing marriage licenses. The US has also given us cases of photographers, bakers, florists and others who happily serve LGBTI people for any other occasion or event, but who cannot in good conscience provide services for a wedding because they see it as participating in an activity which they consider to be immoral. To be clear, these people aren't refusing services on the basis of sexual orientation, but only in relation to the specific event of a wedding. They might believe that by providing services, they're cooperating in an immoral act, or that they are leading others to believe that they support same-sex marriage, what in the Catholic Church we would call causing scandal. Either way, it's something which impacts on their conscience, and the free exercise of conscience is a human right. You might be thinking that service providers should be required to provide services for same-sex weddings. Might give me an analogy of a florist who refuses to serve a person of colour or something similar. But I don't think that a refusal to serve someone of colour is a good analogy because the objection isn't to serving the person. Like I said, many of these places, all of these places, serve LGBTI people on a daily basis, but it's in relation to the specific event for which the services are being provided. And should we really be forcing the hand of businesses in this way? Recently, a group called Marriage Alliance produced some advertisements saying that there was more to the argument about same-sex marriage and used the image of an iceberg. I'm not sure some of you might have seen it. Foxtel ran the advertisements, but a number of television and radio networks refused to run the ad. When Nova declined, they said that the ad was significantly out of alignment with its brand and its audience. Is anyone really thinking that Nova should have been forced to run the ad? And if not, and if it's fair enough that Nova can refuse to run an advertisement which it doesn't think corresponds to its values, isn't it similarly fair enough that a service provider could make the same decision for themselves and for their business? But it doesn't seem at the moment that the introduction of same-sex marriage would allow for conscientious objection for service providers. Australian Marriage Equality National Director Rodney Croom has been writing op-eds saying that these types of exceptions are unnecessary and would open a Pandora's box. Recent inquiries by the Australian Human Rights Commission has seen many submissions, including from various state law societies, lobbying for the removal of all types of religious objections by businesses and educational institutes. Our Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, has said that there should be exemptions and proposed that a wedding service provider might opt out of civil ceremonies to avoid being involved in same-sex marriages. But civil weddings currently comprise 73% of all marriages in Australia. This means that a service provider would have to exclude itself from three-quarters of all of its target demographic in order for them to escape providing services for same-sex marriages, obviously providing severe financial consequences for anyone who chose to do so. And moving away from service providers, let's look at the ability of faith groups to teach their ideas about marriage. Last week in Tasmania, a complaint was made to the Anti-Discrimination Commission against the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference and Archbishop Julian Porteous for distributing a booklet about Catholic teaching on marriage in Catholic schools. The complaint seeks a re-education program for staff and students and a public apology from the Catholic bishops for daring to teach such a thing. Rodney Croom also wants representatives from his organisation to be allowed to give presentations in Catholic schools. At this moment, the law of the land still says that marriage is between a man and a woman, but we are seeing the free exercise of religion and conscience being challenged already. If the law changes, these challenges will only increase. So in conclusion, I think it's too simplistic to suggest that a change in marriage laws will only affect same-sex couples who wish to be married under any new legislation. Laws shape culture. They shape the way we think and behave. And while we may not notice the effects immediately, generations to come will definitely be impacted by the decisions we make today. So we don't only have to think about whether the sun will still rise tomorrow or the day after the marriage laws are changed, but the weather forecast in 50 years' time.
That was Monica Dumit with Same-Sex Marriage Won't Affect You? Some Consequences and Considerations. For more from the University Chaplaincies, and for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.